their way into the only job available, fertilizer-in-chief. The relevant question is whether those applicants are competing against only each other or billions more eager job seekers sent by other men as well. It's hard to conjure a more purely competitive entity than the human spermatozoa. Imagine a teeming school of microscopic salmon whose entire existence consists in straining upstream toward a one-in-several-hundred-million shot at reproduction. Longish odds, you might say. But not all creature sperm face such overwhelmingly slim chances. In some species of insects, for example, fewer than 100 sperm line up for the race to the ovum. Nor are all sperm tiny in comparison to him that sent them. Some species of fruit fly have sperm that measure almost 6 centimeters when uncoiled, several times larger than the fly himself. Homo sapiens is far down at the other extreme, depositing hundreds of millions of tiny sperm at the drop of a hat. Hardcore in the Stone Age. Here's a head-scratcher. Why do so many heterosexual men get off on pornography featuring groups of guys having sex with just one woman? It doesn't add up if you think about it. It's more cone than ice cream. And the suggestive strangeness doesn't end with the counterintuitive male-to-female ratio. It's male ejaculate that puts the money in the money shot. Researchers have confirmed what porn producers already know. Men tend to get turned on by images depicting an environment in which sperm competition is clearly at play, though few, we imagine, think of it in quite these terms. Images and videos showing one woman with multiple males are far more popular on the internet and in commercial pornography than those depicting one male with multiple females. A quick peek at the online offerings at Adult Video Universe lists over 900 titles in the gangbang genre, but only 27 listed under reverse gangbang. You do the math. Why would the males in a species that's been wearing the shackles of monogamy for 1.9 million years be sexually excited by scenes of groups of men ejaculating with one or two women? Skeptics may argue that this arousal could reflect nothing more than commercial interests or a passing fashion. Fair enough, but what to make of experimental evidence that men viewing erotic material suggestive of sperm competition, two men with one woman, produce ejaculates containing a higher percentage of motile sperm than men viewing explicit images of only three women? And why does being cuckolded consistently appear at or near the top of married men's sexual fantasies, according to experts ranging from Alfred Kinsey to Dan Savage? As far as we know, there is no corresponding taste among women for erotica featuring multiple overweight middle-aged ladies with cheap tattoos, bad haircuts, and black socks having sex with one hot guy. Go figure. Could this male appetite for multi-male scenes be an echo of the porn of the Pleistocene? Keep in mind the variety of societies discussed previously in which women assist and inspire teams of workers or hunters by making themselves available for sequential sex. The same dynamic is hinted at on any given Sunday with fluttering pom-poms, the shortest of shorts, and the highest of kicks, ending with sexy young legs spread right down to the astroturf. While there are other conceivable explanations for such oddities of contemporary life, they certainly align well with a prehistory characterized by sperm competition. Go Trojans! Chapter 17. Sometimes a penis is just a penis.
We are right to note the license and disobedience of this member, which thrusts itself forward too inopportunely when we do not want it to, and which so inopportunely lets us down when we most need it. It imperiously contests for authority with our will. It stubbornly and proudly refuses all our incitements, both of the mind and hand. Michel Montaigne, On the Penis. His, presumably.
Don't be distracted by the snickering. the human male takes his genitalia very seriously. In ancient Rome, rich boys wore a bulla, a locket holding a replica of a tiny hard-on. This rocket in a locket was known as a fascinum and signified the young man's upper-class status. Today, writes David Friedman in A Mind of Its Own, his amusing and erudite history of the penis, 1,500 years after the fall of Imperial Rome, anything as powerful or intriguing as an erection is said to be fascinating. Going back a bit farther, we find that in the biblical books of Genesis and Exodus, Jacob's children sprang from his thigh. Most historians agree that thigh is actually a polite way of referring to that which hangs between a man's thighs. It seems clear, writes Friedman, that sacred oaths between Israelites were sealed by placing a hand on the male member. So, according to Friedman at least, the act of swearing on one's balls lives on in the world today. Historical oddities aside, some argue that moderately sized human testicles and lower human sperm concentration relative to chimpanzees and bonobos disprove any significant sperm competition in human evolution. True, the reported range of human sperm concentration of 60 minus 235 times 10 to the 6 per milliliter pales in comparison to that of chimps, an impressive 548 times 10 to the 6th. But not all sperm competition is created equal. For example, some species have seminal fluid that forms a copulatory plug, serving to block the entrance of any subsequent sperm into the cervical canal. Species engaging in this type of sperm competition, snakes, rodents, some insects, kangaroos, typically wield penises with elaborate hooks or curlicues on the end that function to pull any previous male's plug out of the cervical opening. Though at least one team of researchers reports data suggesting men who copulate frequently produce semen that coagulates for a longer time, copulatory plugs don't appear to be in the human sexual arsenal. Despite its lack of curlicues, the human penis is not without interesting design features. Primate sexuality expert Alan Dixon writes, "In primates which live in family groups consisting of an adult pair plus offspring, such as gibbons, the male usually has a small and relatively unspecialized penis. Say what you will about the human penis, but it ain't small or unspecialized." Reproductive biologist Roger Short, real name, writes, "The great size of the erect human penis, in marked contrast to that of the great apes, makes one wonder what particular evolutionary forces have been at work." Jeffrey Miller just comes out and says it. "Adult male humans have the longest, thickest, and most flexible penises of any living primate. So there. Homo sapiens, the great ape with the great penis." The unusual flared glands of the human penis forming the coronal ridge, combined with the repeated thrusting action characteristic of human intercourse, ranging anywhere from 10 to 500 thrusts per romantic interlude, creates a vacuum in the female's reproductive tract. This vacuum pulls any previously deposited semen away from the ovum, thus aiding the sperm about to be sent into action. But wouldn't this vacuum action also draw away a man's own sperm? No, because upon ejaculation, the head of the penis shrinks in size before any loss of tumescence, stiffness, in the shaft, thus neutralizing the suction that might have pulled his own boys back. Very clever. Intrepid researchers have demonstrated this process, known as semen displacement, using artificial semen made of cornstarch, the same recipe used to simulate exaggerated ejaculates in many pornographic films, latex vaginas and artificial penises, in a proper university laboratory setting. Professor Gordon G. Gallup and his team reported that more than 90% of the cornstarch mixture was displaced with just a single thrust of their lab penis. We theorize that as a consequence of competition for paternity, human males evolved uniquely configured penises that function to displace semen from the vagina left by other males, Gallup told BBC News Online. It bears repeating that the human penis is the longest and thickest of any primates, in both absolute and relative terms. And despite all the bad press they get, men last far longer in the saddle than bonobos, 15 seconds, chimps, 7 seconds, or gorillas, 60 seconds, clocking in between 4 and 7 minutes on average. The chimpanzee penis, meanwhile, is a thin, conical appendage without the flared glands of the human member. Nor is sustained thrusting common to chimpanzee or bonobo copulation. But really, how much sustained anything can you expect in 7 seconds? So, while our closest ape cousins may have us beat in the testicles department, they lose to the human penis on size, duration, and cool design features. Furthermore, the average seminal volume in a human ejaculate is about 4 times that of chimpanzees, bringing the total number of sperm cells per ejaculate within range of the chimps. Returning to the question of whether the human scrotum is half empty or half full, the very existence of the external human scrotum suggests sperm competition in human evolution. Gorillas and gibbons, like most other mammals that don't engage in sperm competition, generally aren't equipped for it. A scrotum is like a spare refrigerator in the garage just for beer. If you've got a spare beer fridge, you're probably the type who expects a party to break out at any moment. You want to be prepared. A scrotum fulfills the same function. By keeping the testicles a few degrees cooler than they would be inside the body, a scrotum allows chilled spermatozoa to accumulate and remain viable longer, available if needed. Anyone who's been kicked in the beer fridge can tell you this is a potentially costly arrangement. The increased vulnerability of having testes out there in the wind, inviting attack or accident rather than tucked away safely inside the body, is hard to overstate, especially if you're crumpled in the fetal position, unable to breathe. Given the unrelenting logic of evolutionary cost-benefit analyses, we can be quite certain this is not an adaptation without good reason. Why carry the tools if you don't have the job? There is compelling evidence pointing to a dramatic reduction in human sperm production and testicular volume in recent times. Researchers have documented worrisome decreases in average sperm count, as well as reduced vitality of the sperm that do survive. One researcher suggests that average sperm counts in Danish men have plummeted from 113 times 10 to the 6th in 1940 to about half that in 1990, 66 times 10 to the 6th. The list of potential causes for the collapse is long, ranging from estrogen-like compounds in soybeans and the milk of pregnant cows, to pesticides, fertilizers, growth hormones in cattle, and chemicals used in plastics. Recent research suggests the widely prescribed antidepressant paroxetine, sold as Ceroxat or Paxil, may damage DNA in sperm cells. The human reproduction study at the University of Rochester found that men whose mothers had eaten beef more than 7 times per week while pregnant were 3 times more likely to be classified as subfertile, fewer than 20 million sperm per milliliter of seminal fluid. Among these sons of beef eaters, the rate of subfertility was 17.7%, as opposed to 5.7% among men whose mothers ate beef less often. Humans seem to have much more sperm-producing tissue than any monogamous or polygynous primate would need. Men produce only about 1/3 to 1/8 as much sperm per gram of spermatogenic tissue as 8 other mammals tested. Researchers have noted similar surplus capacities in other aspects of human sperm and semen production physiology. The correlation between infrequent ejaculation and various health problems offers further evidence that present-day men are not using their reproductive equipment to its fullest potential. A team of Australian researchers, for example, found that men who had ejaculated more than 5 times per week between the ages of 20 and 50 were 1/3 less likely to develop prostate cancer later in life. Along with the fructose, potassium, zinc, and other benign components of semen, trace amounts of carcinogens are often present, so researchers hypothesize that the reduction in cancer rates may be due to the frequent flushing of the ducts. A different team from Sydney University reported in late 2007 that daily ejaculation dramatically reduced DNA damage to men's sperm cells, thereby increasing male fertility. Quite the opposite of the conventional wisdom. After 42 men with damaged sperm were instructed to ejaculate daily for a week, almost all showed less chromosomal damage than a control group who had abstained for 3 days. Frequent orgasm is associated with better cardiac health as well. A study conducted at the University of Bristol and Queen's University of Belfast found that men who have 3 or more orgasms per week are 50% less likely to die from coronary heart disease. Use it or lose it is one of the basic tenets of natural selection. With its relentless economizing, evolution rarely equips an organism for a task not performed. If contemporary levels of sperm and semen production were typical of our ancestors, it is unlikely our species would have evolved so much surplus capacity. Contemporary men have far more potential than they use. But if it's true that modern human testicles are mere shadows of their former selves, what happened? Since the infertile leave no descendants, it's a truism in evolutionary theory that infertility can't be inherited. But low fertility can be passed along under certain conditions. As discussed above, chromosomes in humans, chimps, and bonobos, associated with sperm-producing tissue, respond very rapidly to adaptive pressures, far more rapidly than other parts of the genome or the corresponding chromosomes in gorillas, for example. In the reproductive environment we envision, characterized by frequent sexual interaction, females would typically have mated with multiple males during each ovulatory period, as do female chimps and bonobos. Thus, men with impaired fertility would have been unlikely to father children, as their sperm cells would have been overwhelmed by those of other sexual partners. The genes for robust sperm production are strongly favored in such an environment, while mutations resulting in decreased male fertility would have been filtered out of the gene pool, as they still are in chimps and bonobos. But now consider the repercussions of culturally imposed sexual monogamy, even if enforced only for women, as was often the case until recently. In a monogamous mating system, where a woman has sex with only one man, there is no sperm competition with other males. Sex becomes like an election in a dictatorship. Just one candidate can win, no matter how few votes are cast. So even a man with impaired sperm production is likely to ring the bell eventually, thus conceiving sons and perhaps daughters with increased potential for weakened fertility. In this scenario, genes associated with reduced fertility would no longer be removed from the gene pool. They'd spread, resulting in a steady reduction in overall male fertility and generalized atrophy of human sperm production tissue. Just as eyeglasses have allowed survival and reproduction for people with visual incapacities that would have doomed them and their genes in ancestral environments, sexual monogamy permits fertility-reducing mutations to proliferate, causing testicular diminishments that would never have lasted among our non-monogamous ancestors. The most recent estimates show that sperm dysfunction affects about 1 in 20 men around the world, being the single most common cause of subfertility in couples, defined as no pregnancy after a year of trying. Every indication is that the problem is growing steadily worse. Nobody's maintaining the spare fridge much anymore, so it's breaking down. If our paradigm of prehistoric human sexuality is correct, in addition to environmental toxins and food additives, sexual monogamy may be a significant factor in the contemporary infertility crisis. Widespread monogamy may also help explain why, despite our promiscuous past, the testicles of contemporary Homo sapiens are smaller than those of chimps and bonobos, and, as indicated by our excess sperm production capacity, than those of our own ancestors. Sexual monogamy itself may be shrinking men's balls. Perhaps we can declare an end to the standoff between those who argue that small human testicles tell a story of romance and bonding between the sexes going back a long time, perhaps to the beginning of our lineage, and those who contend that our slightly larger than they should be if we're really monogamous testicles indicate many millennia of mild polygyny. Humans have medium-sized testicles by primate standards, with strong indications of recent dwindling, but can still produce ejaculates teeming with hundreds of millions of spermatozoa. Along with a penis adapted to sperm competition, human testicles strongly suggest ancestral females had multiple lovers within a menstrual cycle. Human testicles are the equivalent of drying apples on a November tree, shrinking reminders of days gone by. As a way of testing this hypothesis, we should find that relative penis and testicle data differ among racial and cultural groups. These differences, theoretically due to significant and consistent differences in the intensity of sperm competition in recent historical times, are what we do find if we dare to look. Because fit is so important in the effectiveness of condoms, World Health Organization guidelines specify different sizes for various parts of the world. A 49-millimeter width condom for Asia, a 52-millimeter width for North America and Europe, and a 53-millimeter width for Africa. All condoms are longer than most men will ever need. The condoms manufactured in China for their domestic market are 49 millimeters wide. According to a study conducted by the Indian Council of Medical Research, high levels of slippage and failure are due to a bad fit between many Indian men and the international standards used in condom manufacture. According to an article published in Nature, Japanese and Chinese men's testicles tend to be smaller than those of Caucasian men on average. The authors of the study concluded that differences in body size make only a slight contribution to these values. Other researchers have confirmed these general trends, finding average combined testes weights of 24 grams for Asians, 29 to 33 grams for Caucasians, and 50 grams for Africans. Researchers found marked differences in testis size among human races. Even controlling for age differences among samples, adult male Danes have testes that are more than twice the size of their Chinese equivalents, for example. This ranges far beyond what average racial differences in body size would predict. Various estimates conclude that Caucasians produce about twice the number of spermatozoa per day than do Chinese, 185 minus 235 times 10 to the 6th, compared with 84 times 10 to the 6th. These are dangerous waters we're swimming in, dear reader, suggesting that culture, environment, and behavior can be reflected in anatomy, genital anatomy at that. But any serious biologist or physician knows there are anatomical differences expressed racially. Despite the hair-trigger sensitivity of these issues, not to consider racial background in the diagnosis and treatment of disease would be unethical. Still, some of the reluctance to connect culturally sanctioned behavior with genital anatomy is as much due to the difficulty of finding reliable historical information about true rates of female promiscuity as to the emotionally charged nature of the material itself. Furthermore, diet and environmental factors would have to be factored in before arriving at any solid conclusions regarding the relationship between sexual monogamy and genital anatomy. For example, many Asian diets include large quantities of soy products, while many Western people consume large quantities of beef, both having been shown to cause rapid generational reduction in testicular volume and spermatogenesis. Given the controversial nature of such research and the complexities of eliminating so many variables, perhaps it's not surprising that this is an area few researchers are eager to enter. There is a wide world of evidence that human sexual activity goes far beyond what's needed for reproduction. While the social function of sex is now seen mainly in terms of maintaining the nuclear family, this is far from the only way societies channel human sexual energies to promote social stability. Coming in at hundreds or thousands of copulations per child born, human beings outcopulate even chimpanzees and bonobos and are far beyond gorillas and gibbons. When the average duration of each copulation is factored in, the sheer amount of time spent in sexual activity by human beings easily surpasses that of any other primate, even if we agree to ignore all our fantasizing, dreaming, and masturbating. The evidence that sperm competition played a role in human evolution is simply overwhelming. In the words of one researcher, without sperm warfare during human evolution, men would have tiny genitals and produce few sperm. There would be no thrusting during intercourse, no sex dreams or fantasies, no masturbation, and we would each feel like having intercourse only a dozen or so times in our entire lives. Sex and society, art and literature, in fact the whole of human culture, would be different. We can add to this list the fact that men and women would be the same height and weight, if monogamous, or that men would likely be twice the size of women, if polygynous. Just as Darwin's famous finches in the Galapagos evolved different beak structures for cracking different seeds, related species often evolve different mechanisms for sperm competition. The sexual evolution of chimps and bonobos followed a strategy dependent upon repeated ejaculations of small but highly concentrated deposits of sperm cells, while humans evolved an approach featuring a penis designed to pull back pre-existing sperm with extended, repeated thrusting, less frequent compared to chimps and bonobos, but larger ejaculates, testicular volume and libido far beyond what's needed for monogamous or polygynous mating, rapid reaction DNA controlling development of testicular tissue, this DNA apparently being absent in monogamous or polygynous primates, overall sperm content per ejaculate, even today, in the range of chimps and bonobos, and the precarious location of the testicles in a vulnerable external scrotum associated with promiscuous mating. In Spanish, the word esperar can mean to expect or to hope, depending on context. Archaeology, writes Bagucki, is very much constrained by what the modern imagination allows in the range of human behavior. So is evolutionary theory. Perhaps so many still conclude that sexual monogamy is characteristic of our species' evolutionary past, despite the clear messages inscribed in every man's body and appetites, because this is what they expect and hope to find there. Chapter 18. The Prehistory of O.
Now there you have a sample of man's reasoning powers, as he calls them. He observes certain facts, for instance, that in all his life he never sees the day that he can satisfy one woman. Also that no woman ever sees the day that she can't overwork and defeat and put out of commission any 10 masculine plants that can be put to bed to her. He puts those strikingly suggestive and luminous facts together, and from them draws this astonishing conclusion. The Creator intended the woman to be restricted to one man. Mark Twain, Letters from the Earth.
We recently spotted a young man strolling down Las Ramblas in Barcelona, proudly sporting a T-shirt proclaiming that he was born to fuck. One wonders whether he has a whole set of these shirts at home. Born to breathe, born to eat, born to drink, born to shit, and of course, the depressing but inevitable, born to die. But maybe he was making a deeper point. After all, the argument central to this book is that sex has long served many crucial functions for Homo sapiens, with reproduction being only the most obvious among them. Since we human beings spend more time and energy planning, executing, and recalling our sexual exploits than any other species on Earth, maybe we should all wear such shirts. Or maybe just the women. When it comes to sex, men may be trash-talking sprinters, but it's the women who win all the marathons. Any marriage counselor will tell you the most common sex-related complaint women make about men is that they are too quick and too direct. Meanwhile, men's most frequent sex-related gripe about women is that they take too damned long to get warmed up. After an orgasm, a woman may be anticipating a dozen more. A female body in motion tends to stay in motion, but men come and go. For them, the curtain falls quickly and the mind turns to unrelated matters. This symmetry of dual disappointment illustrates the almost comical incompatibility between men's and women's sexual response in the context of monogamous mating. You have to wonder, if men and women evolved together in sexually monogamous couples for millions of years, how did we end up being so incompatible? It's as if we've been sitting down to dinner together millennium after millennium, but half of us can't help wolfing everything down in a few frantic, sloppy minutes, while the other half are still setting the table and lighting candles. Yes, we know, mixed strategies, lots of cheap sperm versus a few expensive eggs in one basket and so on. But these flagrantly maladjusted sexual responses make far more sense when viewed as relics of our having evolved in promiscuous groups. Rather than spinning theories within theories in an effort to prop up an unstable paradigm, monogamy with mistakes, mild polygyny, mixed mating strategies, serial monogamy, can we simply face the one scenario where none of this self-contradicting, inconsistent, special pleading is necessary? Okay, fine, it's embarrassing, maybe even humiliating if you're prone to that sort of thing, but 150 years after On the Origin of Species was published, isn't it time to accept that our ancestors evolved along a sexual trajectory similar to that of our two highly social, very intelligent, closely related primate cousins? With any other question we have about the origins of human behavior, we look to chimps and bonobos for important clues: language, tool use, political alliances, war, reconciliation, altruism. But when it comes to sex, we prudishly turn away from these models to the distantly related antisocial, low IQ, but monogamous gibbon? Really? We've pointed out how the agricultural revolution triggered radical social reconfigurations from which we're still reeling. Perhaps the far-fetched denial of our promiscuous sexual prehistory expresses a legitimate fear of social instability, but insistent demands for a stable social order, based, as we're often reminded, upon the nuclear family unit, cannot erase the effects of the hundreds of thousands of years that came before our species settled into stable villages. If female chimps and bonobos could talk, do we really think they'd be griping to their hairy girlfriends about prematurely ejaculating males who don't bring flowers anymore? Probably not, because as we've seen, when a female chimp or bonobo is in the mood, she's likely to be the center of plenty of eager male attraction. And the more attention she gets, the more she attracts, because, as it turns out, our male primate cousins get turned on by the sight and sound of others of their species having sex. Imagine that.
What horrid extravagancies of mind! No man, who is but never so little versed in such matters, is ignorant what grievous symptoms the rising, bearing down, and perversion and convulsion of the womb do excite. What horrid extravagancies of mind, what frenzies, melancholy distempers, and outrageousness the preternatural diseases of the womb do induce, as if affected persons were enchanted. William Harvey, Anatomical Exercitations Concerning the Generation of Living Creatures, 1653.
Hysteria was one of the first diseases to be described formally. Hippocrates discussed it in the 4th century BCE, and you'll find it in any medical text covering women's health written from medieval times until it was removed from the list of recognized medical diagnoses in 1952, 21 years before homosexuality was finally removed. Hysteria was still one of the most diagnosed diseases in the United States and Great Britain as recently as the early 20th century. You might wonder how physicians treated this chronic condition over the centuries. We'll tell you. Doctors masturbated their female patients to orgasm. According to historian Rachel Maines, female patients were routinely massaged to orgasm from the time of Hippocrates until the 1920s. Have a seat. The doctor will be right with you. While some passed the job off to nurses, most physicians performed the therapy themselves, though apparently not without some difficulty. Nathaniel Highmore, writing in 1660, noted that it was not an easy technique to learn, being not unlike that game of boys in which they try to rub their stomachs with one hand and pat their heads with the other. Whatever challenges male physicians faced in mastering the technique, it seems to have been worth the effort. The Health and Diseases of Women, published in 1873, estimates that about 75% of American women were in need of these treatments, and that they constituted the single largest market for therapeutic services. Despite Donald Simmons's protestations that, among all peoples, sexual intercourse is understood to be a service or favor that females render to males, it seems that for centuries, orgasmic release was a service male doctors rendered to women, for a price. Much of this information comes from The Technology of Orgasm, Maines's wonderful book on this disease and its treatment through the centuries. And what were the symptoms of this disease? Unsurprisingly, they were identical to those of sexual frustration and chronic arousal. Anxiety, sleeplessness, irritability, nervousness, erotic fantasy, sensations of heaviness in the abdomen, lower pelvic edema, and vaginal lubrication. This supposed medical treatment for horny, frustrated women was not an isolated aberration confined to ancient history, but just one element in an ancient crusade to pathologize the demands of the female libido, a libido that experts have long insisted hardly exists. The men who provided this lucrative therapy didn't write about orgasm in the medical articles they published on hysteria and its treatment. Rather, they published serious, sober discussion of vulvular massage leading to nervous paroxysm that brought temporary relief to the patient. These were ideal patients, after all. They didn't die or recover from their condition. They just kept returning, eager for more treatment sessions. This arrangement might strike some readers as the very definition of good work if you can get it, but many physicians apparently felt otherwise. Maines found no evidence that male physicians enjoyed providing pelvic massage treatments. On the contrary, this male elite sought every opportunity to substitute other devices for their fingers. What other devices does Maines have in mind? See if you can finish this series. 1. Sewing machine. 2. Fan. 3. Tea kettle. 4. Toaster. 5. Here's a hint. These are the first 5 electrical appliances sold directly to American consumers. Give up? The Hamilton Beach Company of Racine, Wisconsin, patented the first home-use vibrator in 1902, thereby making it just the 5th electrical appliance approved for domestic use. By 1917, there were more vibrators than toasters in American homes. But before it became an instrument for self-treatment, all the pleasures of youth will throb within you, one suggestive ad promised. Vibrators had already been in use for decades in the offices of physicians who'd grown weary of rubbing their stomachs and patting their heads at the same time. Motivated by the wonders of industrialization, many doctors had sought a way to mechanize the delivery of their treatment. American ingenuity would mass-produce orgasms for women who were denied them in their properly chaste, sexually deprived lives. The first vibrators were invented by these enterprising physicians. Late 19th and early 20th century medical tinkerers designed all sorts of devices to provoke the necessary nervous paroxysms in their patients. Some were diesel-powered, others ran on steam, like little locomotives that could. Some were huge contraptions hanging from the rafters on chains and pulleys, like engine blocks at an auto shop. Others sported pistons thrusting dildos through holes in tables, or involved high-pressure water directed at the patient's genitalia, like a fire brigade called in to douse the consuming flames of female passion. And all the while, the good doctors never publicly admitted that what they were doing was more sex than medicine. But perhaps even more dumbfounding than their silence on being paid to provoke nervous paroxysms, like so many Chippendale studs, is the fact that these same medical authorities managed to maintain the conviction that female sexuality was a weak and reluctant thing. The medical monopoly on providing socially acceptable extramarital orgasms to women was assured by a strict prohibition against women or girls masturbating themselves to orgasm. In 1850, the New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal declared masturbation public enemy number one, warning, "Neither plague, nor war, nor smallpox, nor a crowd of similar evils have resulted more disastrously for humanity than the habit of masturbation. It is the destroying element of civilized society." Children and adults were warned that masturbation was not only sinful, but very dangerous, sure to result in severe health consequences, including blindness, infertility, and insanity. Besides, these authorities intoned, normal women had little sexual desire anyway. In his Psychopathia Sexualis, published in 1886, German neurologist Richard von Krafft-Ebing declared what everyone already thought they knew. If a woman is normally developed mentally and well-bred, her sexual desire is small. If this were not so, the whole world would become a brothel and marriage and a family impossible. To have suggested that women enjoyed, indeed needed, regular orgasmic release would have been shocking to men and humiliating to most women. Perhaps it still is. While the anti-masturbation frenzy has roots deep in Judeo-Christian history, it found unfortunate medical support in Simon André Tissot's A Treatise on the Disease Produced by Onanism, published in 1758. Tissot apparently recognized the symptoms of syphilis and gonorrhea, which were considered a single disease at the time. But he misunderstood these symptoms as signs of semen depletion due to promiscuity, prostitution, and masturbation. A century later, in 1858, a British gynecologist named Isaac Baker Brown, president of the Medical Society of London at the time, proposed that most women's diseases were attributable to overexcitement of the nervous system, with the pudic nerve, which runs to the clitoris, being particularly culpable. He listed the 8 stages of progressive disease triggered by female masturbation. 1. Hysteria. 2. Spinal irritation. 3. Hysterical epilepsy. 4. Cataleptic fits. 5. Epileptic fits. 6. Idiocy. 7. Mania. 8. Death. Baker Brown argued that surgical removal of the clitoris was the best way to prevent this fatal slide from pleasure to idiocy to death. After gaining considerable celebrity and performing an unknown number of clitorectomies, Baker Brown's methods fell out of favor and he was expelled from the London Obstetrical Society in disgrace. Baker Brown subsequently went insane, and clitorectomy was discredited in British medical circles. Unfortunately, Baker Brown's writing had already had a significant impact on medical practice across the Atlantic. Clitorectomies continued to be performed in the United States well into the 20th century as a cure for hysteria, nymphomania, and female masturbation. As late as 1936, Holt's Diseases of Infancy and Childhood, a respected medical school text, recommended surgical removal or cauterization of the clitoris as a cure for masturbation in girls. By the middle of the 20th century, as the procedure was finally falling into disrepute in the United States, it was revived with a new rationale. Now, rather than a way to stamp out masturbation, surgical removal of large clitorises was recommended for cosmetic purposes. Before becoming a target for surgery, the clitoris had been ignored by male authors of elaborate anatomical sketchbooks for centuries. It wasn't until the mid-1500s that a Venetian professor by the name of Matteo Realdo Colombo, who had previously studied anatomy with Michelangelo, stumbled upon a mysterious protuberance between a woman's legs. As described in Federico Andahasi's historical novel The Anatomist, Colombo made this discovery while examining a patient named Inés de Torremolinos. Colombo noted that Inés grew tense when he manipulated this small button and that it appeared to grow in size at his touch. Clearly, this would require further exploration. After examining scores of other women, Colombo found that all of them had this same heretofore undiscovered protuberance and that they all responded similarly to gentle manipulation. In March of 1558, Andahasi tells us that Colombo proudly reported his discovery of the clitoris to the dean of his faculty. As Jonathan Margolis speculates in O, The Intimate History of the Orgasm, the response was probably not what Colombo had anticipated. The professor was arrested in his classroom within days, accused of heresy, blasphemy, witchcraft, and Satanism, put on trial, and imprisoned. His manuscripts were confiscated, and his discovery was never permitted to be mentioned again until centuries after his death. Beware the devil's teat. The illness that led frustrated women to the offices of vibrator-wielding doctors a century ago often led someplace far worse in medieval Europe. As historian Ray Tannehill explains, the Malleus Maleficarum, 1486, the first great handbook of the witch inquisitors, had no more difficulty than a modern psychoanalyst in accepting that a certain type of woman might readily believe she had had intercourse with the devil himself, a huge, black, monstrous being with an enormous penis and seminal fluid as cold as ice water. But it wasn't only sexual dreams that attracted the brutal attentions of erotophobic authorities. If a witch hunter in the 1600s discovered a woman or girl with an unusually large clitoris, this devil's teat was sufficient to condemn her to death. Medieval Europe suffered periodic plagues of incubi and succubi, male and female demons thought to be invading the dreams, beds, and bodies of living people. Thomas Aquinas and others believed that these demons impregnated women on their nocturnal visits by first posing as a succubus, a female spirit who has sex with a sleeping man in order to obtain his sperm, and then depositing the sperm in an unsuspecting woman in the form of an incubus, a male spirit ravishing a sleeping woman. Women thus thought to have been impregnated by malevolent spirits flitting about like nocturnal honeybees were at special risk of being exposed as witches and dealt with accordingly. Any stories these women might have told regarding the true origins of their pregnancy conveniently died with them. Though now considered one of the finest novels ever written, Madame Bovary was denounced as immoral when it was first published in late 1856. Public prosecutors in Paris were upset that Gustave Flaubert portrayed a headstrong peasant girl who flaunted the rules of established propriety by taking lovers. They felt her character met with insufficient punishment. Flaubert's defense was that the work was eminently moral on those terms. After all, Emma Bovary dies by her own hand in misery, poverty, shame, and desperation. Insufficient punishment? The case against the book, in other words, turned on whether Emma Bovary's punishment was agonizing and horrible enough, not on whether she deserved such suffering at all or had any right to pursue sexual fulfillment in the first place. But even Flaubert and his misogynistic prosecutors could never have dreamed up the punishments said to befall immodest women among the Tzotzil Maya of Central America. Sarah Blaffer-Hurdy explains that the Ikal, a super-sex demon with a several-foot-long penis, seizes women who have misbehaved, carrying them off to his cave, where he rapes them. Little girls are told that any woman unlucky enough to become pregnant by the Ikal swells up and then gives birth night after night until she dies. This apparent need to punish female sexual desire as something evil, dangerous, and pathological is not limited to medieval times or remote Mayan villages. Recent estimates by the World Health Organization suggest that approximately 137 million girls undergo some form of genital mutilation every year.
The force required to suppress it. A fire is never sated by any amount of logs, nor the ocean by rivers that flow into it, Death cannot be sated by all the creatures in the world, nor a fair-eyed woman by any amount of men. The Kama Sutra.
Before the war on drugs, the war on terror, or the war on cancer, there was the war on female sexual desire. It's a war that has been raging far longer than any other, and its victims number well into the billions by now. Like the others, it's a war that can never be won, as the declared enemy is a force of nature. We may as well declare war on the cycles of the moon. There is a pathetic futility animating the centuries-long insistence, against overwhelming evidence to the contrary, that the human female is indifferent to the insistent urgings of libido. Recall the medical authorities in the antebellum South who assured plantation owners that slaves trying to break out of their chains were not human beings deserving of freedom and dignity, but sufferers of drapetomania, a medical disorder best cured with a good lashing. And who can forget the well-intentioned Inquisition that forced Galileo to disown truths as obvious to him as they were offensive to minds calcified by power and doctrine? In this ongoing struggle between what is and what many post-agricultural patriarchal societies insist must be, women who have dared to renounce the credo of the coy female are still spat upon, insulted, divorced, separated from their children, banished, burned as witches, pathologized as hysterics, buried to their necks in desert sand, and stoned to death. They and their children, those sons and daughters of bitches, are still sacrificed to the perverse, conflicted gods of ignorance, shame, and fear. If psychiatrist Mary Jane Scherfe was correct when she wrote, "The strength of the drive determines the force required to suppress it," an observation downright Newtonian in its irrefutable simplicity, then what are we to make of the force brought to bear on the suppression of female libido? Chapter 19. When Girls Go Wild. Female copulatory vocalization. Here's a question we ask the audience every time we give a public presentation. If you've ever heard a heterosexual couple having sex, and who hasn't, which partner was louder? The answer we get every time, every place, from men, women, straight, gay, American, French, Japanese, and Brazilians, is always the same. Hands down, no question about it. Not even close. We don't have to tell you because you already know, don't you? Yes, the meek, demure, coy sex is the source of the high-decibel moaning, groaning, and calling out to the good Lord above, neighbors be damned. But why? Within the framework of the standard narrative of human sexuality, what scientists call female copulatory vocalization, FCV, is a major conundrum. You'll recall Steven Pinker's claim that, in all societies, sex is at least somewhat dirty. It is conducted in private. Why would the female of such a species risk attracting all that attention? Why is it that from the Lower East Side to the upper reaches of the Amazon, women are far more likely than men to loudly announce their sexual pleasure for all to hear? And why is the sound of a woman having an orgasm so difficult for heterosexual men to ignore? They say women can hear a baby crying from a great distance, but gentlemen, we ask you, is there any sound easier to pick out of the cacophony of an apartment block and harder to ignore than that of a woman lost in passion? If you're one of the 10 or 15 people alive who have never seen Meg Ryan's fake orgasm scene in When Harry Met Sally, go watch it now. It's easily accessible online. It's one of the best-known scenes in all of modern cinema, but if the roles were reversed, the scene wouldn't be funny. It wouldn't even make sense. Imagine, Billy Crystal sits at the restaurant table. He starts breathing harder. Maybe his eyes bug out a bit. He grunts a few times, takes a few bites of his sandwich, and falls asleep. No big laughs. Nobody in the deli even notices. If male orgasm is a muffled crash of cymbals, female orgasm is a full-on opera, full of screaming, shouting, singing people standing around with spears, and table-pounding sure to quiet even the noisiest New York deli. Female cries of ecstasy aren't a modern phenomenon. The Kama Sutra contains ancient advice on female copulatory vocalization in terms of erotic technique, categorizing an aviary of ecstatic expression a woman might choose from. As a major part of moaning, she may use, according to her imagination, the cries of the dove, cuckoo, green pigeon, parrot, bee, nightingale, goose, duck, and partridge. A goose? Honk if you heart sex. But apart from barnyard erotic technique, it just doesn't make sense for the female of a monogamous or mildly polygynous species to call attention to herself when mating. On the other hand, if thousands of generations of multiple mating are built into modern human sexuality, it's pretty clear what all the shouting's about. As it turns out, women aren't the only female primates making a lot of noise in the throes of passion. British primatologist Stuart Semple found that, in a wide variety of species, females vocalize just before, during, and immediately after they mate. These vocalizations, Semple says, are particularly common among the primates, and evidence is now accumulating that by calling, a female incites males in her group. Precisely. There's a good reason the sound of a woman enjoying a sexual encounter entices a heterosexual man. Her copulation call is a potential invitation to come hither, thus provoking sperm competition. Semple recorded more than 550 copulation calls from 7 different female baboons and analyzed their acoustic structure. He found that these complex vocalizations contained information related both to the female's reproductive state, the vocalizations were more complex when females were closer to ovulation, and to the status of the male inspiring any given vocalization. Calls were longer and contained more distinct sonic units during matings with higher-ranked males. Thus, in these baboons at least, listening males could presumably gain information as to their likelihood of impregnating a calling female, as well as some sense of the rank of the male they'd find with her if they approached. Meredith Small agrees that the copulation calls of female primates are easily identifiable. Even the uninitiated can identify female non-human primate orgasm or sexual pleasure. Females, Small tells us, make noises not heard in any other context but mating. Female lion-tailed macaques use copulation calls to invite male attention even when not ovulating. Small reports that among these primates, ovulating females most often directed their invitations at males outside their own troop, thus bringing new blood into the mating mix. Female copulatory vocalization is highly associated with promiscuous mating, but not with monogamy. Alan Dixon has noted that the females of promiscuous primate species emit more complex mating calls than females of monogamous or polygynous species. Complexity aside, Gauri Pradhan and his colleagues conducted a survey of copulation calls in a variety of primates and found that variation in females' promiscuity predicts their tendency to use copulation calls in conjunction with mating. Their data shows that higher levels of promiscuity predict more frequent copulation calls. William J. Hamilton and Patricia C. Arrowwood analyzed the copulatory vocalizations of various primates, including 3 human couples going at it. They noticed that female sounds gradually intensified as orgasm approached, and at orgasm assumed a rapid, regular, equal note lengths and inter-note intervals, rhythm absent in the male's calls at orgasm. Still, the authors can't help sounding a tad let down when they note, neither sex of human showed the complexity of note structure characteristic of baboon copulatory vocalizations. But that's probably a good thing, because elsewhere in their article, we learn that female baboons' copulation calls are clearly audible to even human ears from 300 meters away. Before you conclude that female copulatory vocalization is just a fancy phrase for a little excitement, think about the predators possibly alerted by this primate passion. Chimps and bonobos may be out of reach up in the branches, but baboons, like our grand-dwelling ancestors, live among leopards and other predators who would be quite interested in a 2-for-1 special on fresh primate, especially given a mating pair's distracted, vulnerable state. As Hamilton and Arrowwood put it, in spite of the risk of exposure of individuals and the troop to predators, these baboons habitually call during copulation, so the calls must have some adaptive value. What could that be? The authors offered several hypotheses, including the notion that the